Today on The Grave Talks, Are They Really Dead? A conversation with Amelia Cotter. Amelia Cotter has always been drawn to the paranormal. As a young girl, she found herself drawn to the abandoned mansion that stood steps outside the doors of her father's restaurant. Amelia would spend her hours exploring the abandoned rooms, halls, and living spaces that someone at some time called home. She imagined what life must have been like for the family who lived there. Eventually, one day, she would come face to face with a former resident. A resident who had passed on, and one she would come to name Walter. This would be the beginning of a lifelong journey exploring the world of the supernatural for Amelia Cotter.
Well, I guess I've taken two parallel paths. From when I was a child, I became interested both in ghosts and in the world of writing. And because of that, I was at the library at a very young age, even before I was really good with reading. I would spend a lot of time in what was then called the occult section, where all of the awesome ghost story books and UFO and Bigfoot and even, you know, what we now consider the occult, those were all in kind of lumped into one place. I would just, you know, eat up all of that information. And I remember growing interested in ghost hunting. Now, at the time, I was like, probably about 8 or 9 years old. So my junior ghost hunting expeditions were very, very probably what we would think of as cute. And I had a little junior like ghost hunting book that was for kids. And I grew up in Maryland, so I had the unique opportunity to explore a lot of the abandoned and historic places that I grew up near. So my dad worked at a restaurant in Baltimore County, and on the property, it was a historic building that had once been a barn in the 1700s, had been converted to a tavern. And then by the time we got to the late 1990s, it was like a fine dining restaurant. And there were some other houses on the property. Some of them were occupied, some of them weren't. One of them was this beautiful, creepy, old abandoned house that people in the area referred to affectionately as Walter's house. And so I kind of got my feet wet as a young ghost hunter exploring that house. And actually, I was around the age of 11 when I started writing journal entries about the place, becoming really deeply interested in the stories that people would tell. And my parents would kind of supervise me. So sometimes I did actually go into the house by myself with my mom nearby, which some people might think is weird, but I kind of thought it was cool. Mm-hmm. I was obviously a nerdy kid anyway, hanging out at the library all the time. So I was trustworthy. And then sometimes they would come with me. And I developed a fascination with Walter's house and trying to imagine who this ghost might have been, or ghosts. They just sort of referred to every bit of paranormal activity would be blamed on Walter. And I did have my first ghostly experience there.
What happened? The house.
Go ahead, sorry.
I said, what happened for you in the house?
Well, I had explored there many times. I had wanted very badly to see the ghost. So I know that that can be considered sometimes a little dicey when somebody sort of opens themselves up to that kind of activity. Obviously, I was a kid, and so I was probably in a vulnerable place. But I remember I was leaving the house one day with my mom and a friend, and I looked up into the attic windows, and in the attic window, there was a man, a young man, I presume, leaning out with both of his hands on the windowsill, looking out at me. And I could see all of the details of his clothing and his hair, except that everything was completely stark white. So he was solid but white, and he had no face, so no facial features. So it sounds kind of terrifying, but in the moment, it was, honestly, it was pretty exhilarating. I was not really afraid. I was more enthralled and curious at what I was looking at, and I had this weird sensation that he could also tell that I could see him and was surprised that I could see him. I remember even though I was standing kind of far away at that point, not far away, but like I was at least 20 feet away. I remember that I got like a static electric feeling all over my body. And I just felt like I had made this connection. And it wasn't negative in any way. And nothing, you know, nothing bad happened to me after that. And that really, so I had this love and this affection for this house. And then I felt I made this connection with this spirit, whoever it may have been. I was interested in the history of the house, but I was a little too young to really flesh out, like doing a lot of research and everything into finding out who Walter, in quotation fingers, may have been. But it was really overall a positive experience that I sort of saw as like a coming of age kind of adventure. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of been my approach with my interest in the paranormal, is sort of coming at it from a place of curiosity and wonder.
Yeah. I mean, a perfect environment to be out there wandering around to these kind of creepy, sometimes abandoned locations as a child. That's very similar to what my story was, too, as far as finding an interest in this. Mine was wandering the woods and going into an old cemetery. And I didn't have one specific incident, but overall, just the atmosphere is what got me interested in the topic. So when you had this moment where you were in the house and you saw this figure, you said it was an overall positive experience. I would imagine a lot of kids having this happen to them, even if they are searching it out, even if they are in the house because it's spooky, because they want to explore it, still having that. How did you keep calm? How did you walk out of there?
Well, it
feeling
was
positive.
I mean, I guess I'll tell you, if this would happen to me now as an adult with all of the anxiety that I have and, you know, a lifetime of experiences and a different relationship with death, you know, now as an adult, I think I would have had a much different reaction. But as a kid, I was just fascinated. Mm-hmm. And in the moment, I was so shocked and taken aback by what I was seeing that I didn't really fully react until much later. And I think I've heard a lot of people tell stories about that, kids and adults, when they have like a bizarre experience, it sort of doesn't register until they don't know what to make of it until like a certain time after. And I feel like that's, you know, with kids especially, and I guess speaking from my own experience, I just sort of went into like a kind of like a state of where everything was just surreal for that one moment. It was like a state of shock, but not in necessarily in a bad way.
Did you communicate this to your parents or to your mom, what you had experienced right at that time?
I did. And so my friend from school had come with me because I had given this goofy presentation on ghosts at school. And he said he wanted to come with me and see, you know, the house. And he had seen what I had seen. So we were able to kind of corroborate our story. I asked him first to describe to me what he saw. And he said he saw, you know, youngish looking dude or, you know, man, short man, you know, hanging out of the window. But my mom didn't see it. And I remember she believed us, and she was excited for us. And she was a little envious, but also not, because I think she had the same sensation we were kind of just talking about, where like maybe she would just rather not have that experience, but she was glad that we did. I think my parents also kind of, they took me seriously, but they also found it kind of cute that this was a hobby that I had. So I think a lot of what they did was just sort of humoring me.
Sure. Well, I mean, as a parent, you hear a child say that, and having obviously done this and talked to hundreds of people who've had situations, the best thing to do is to not dismiss your child and say, no, it's nothing, but to at the very least humor them. So that's good.
Validating the experience, right? Yeah.
Exactly. So obviously you had the experience, a friend had the experience. You didn't necessarily need someone else to validate it and tell you that this in fact did happen. But did you walk out of there wondering at all? Was there any question in your mind of, did that really just happen? Or did my mind kind of manufacture that because we were so amped up, ready to go into this haunted house?
No, it was so real. Mm-hmm. It was so mundane. It was like as if I would sit across the table from just another person. So my brain registered it as not as something odd until, of course, I started to take in the details and everything. It was just as if I was encountering a person. And then I felt that swirling sensation, this static electricity. And then I saw that, you know, he was completely white without these facial features and all that. And it grew from there, but I never doubted it. And as time has gone on, I've never had an experience like that again. I've never seen anything like that again. And that's been with much deeper, you know, research and adventures into the paranormal and haunted places. So especially after time now, I can say that that was the most real thing that I could possibly have seen. There's been a lot of other times when I've doubted myself,
sure.
But not that one.
So what ultimately is the history of this house and Walter when you did get a bit older and had a chance to do some research on the property?
The property was originally owned, and this would have been like a large expanse of land, by Lord Baltimore, and he had gifted it to his wife around the time that, you know, he established the Baltimore County area, I guess.
Sure.
I would say. And so this house was built probably in the late 1700s. And the last artifacts that I had seen in the house that were the most recent things of from its abandonment were actually from the 1950s. So it had been abandoned since the 1950s, and there was still furniture in the house. There was an old can of like carnation milk still sitting on the kitchen table. And then there was also just a lot of clutter and debris, and people had picked it apart, but then they had left some other things. It was very interesting. The extent of my research has really been just the understanding of the general area. I didn't ever really look too much into who owned the house or who Walter might have been. That's always been sort of this like kind of sacred space for me, of allowing it to be a mystery, because I know that we enjoy, as in storytelling and also with regard to the paranormal, and we like to tie everything up neatly with a bow. But the mystery for me is part of the allure. And so I kind of wanted to leave it be what it was.
So do you have any factual inclination of this Walter character existing? Was this just a name that was thrown around at the time, or where does the origin of the name come from?
That's a great question. So the name came from an incident that occurred in the restaurant one morning when one of the guys from the cleaning crew was there super early in the AM vacuuming the floor and tidying things up. And he said that he saw somebody out of the corner of his eye. And when he looked up, he saw a woman in a beautiful, like green, like Victorian looking dress come like swooshing into the room. And she walked right up to him and asked him, excuse me, can you tell me where Walter is? And then he sort of like shook his head, like dumbfounded. And then she turned from him and walked into a wall and disappeared. And apparently the story goes that he quit that day and like walked out and never came back. He only called in to say that this crazy thing had happened to him. And so from there, everybody would refer to any spirit that they encountered on the property as Walter. And now I also referred to, you know, the house, which was adjacent to the parking lot of the restaurant. I mean, if you sat on the patio, mm-hmm. You could see the house while you were eating. And so I would refer to the ghost also as Walter, even though I would say, hey, I don't really know if this is your real name, or even if there's more than one of you. So I had the wisdom to do that when I was a kiddo, but I sensed that there was that male presence. But beyond that, I don't really know.
The area that we're talking about here, the restaurant's right there. One of the cleaning individuals had an experience in the restaurant. You had the experience in the house. It's all pretty much on the same area or plot of land. Do you believe that it's something to do with the general area, the general vicinity, that there was something, someone or multiple entities haunting that general area from well before the restaurant existed, that they're still there from?
I think they would be people that are connected to the property. So across the street from the restaurant was a large mansion The restaurant itself had been like a stable and a tavern at one time, and probably a residence. And then there were these other clusters of residences around there. So I have a feeling it sort of resembled like an older, like a tight-knit community. And I would imagine that those spirits were just people that had lived their lives there and were still connected to the area. And I guess I would also say, judging from the way that the clothing looked on the figure that I saw, that I referred to as Walter, that figure looked like he could have come from like the late 1700s or early 1800s. He had like suspenders with a long sleeve shirt that were gathered at the cuffs. So it sort of was reminiscent of that style.
Mm-hmm. When you had the experience as a child, and obviously this is prior to ghost shows being anything like they are today, or the culture of paranormal investigating being like it is today. There was Unsolved Mysteries and there was a handful of other things out.
But the
level to which it's accepted to talk about or that it's mainstream, really wasn't there. So did you share with your friends what you had seen other than the one that was with you? Or were they accepting of this?
Well, so yes and no. I had a couple of friends that thought that stuff was cool. I should preface it by saying that I really didn't have that many friends. So I gave this presentation about ghost hunting at school, and even my teacher said, I thought this was going to be a frivolous topic that you were going to present on, but I really enjoyed it. And so people kind of took it seriously and didn't. So a few people thought it was neat, and then I felt comfortable talking about it around my family because I just grew up around people kind of telling ghost stories around the table. So it was more acceptable to talk about it at home than outside.
Sure.
Which for some people is the opposite. It's I had an interesting experience.
Sure. Once you let that out there and you said, this was my experience, this is what happened to me at this house, did other people begin to come forward? Did you ever hear other stories of experiences of people with that house?
My dad and I, at his work would kind of, interview people, or he would ask his coworkers about stuff, and people mostly had experiences that had happened to them within the restaurant. But shortly after my experience, there was a drunk driving accident out on the road next to the house. So the house was about 15 feet from a road that curved very sharply. And it was like a country road, but there was a little guardrail there. And a woman had apparently passed out at the wheel and gone through the guardrail directly toward the house. And then at the very last second, her car swerved away from the house and then swerved again so that it kind of landed and came to a stop right in the field next to the house. And the guardrail, it was actually pushed up onto the porch. And everybody who was there on the scene or saw the scene later, because there were still like skid marks in the grass for like a week or two, said that it had to have been the ghosts in Walter's house, or the ghost of Walter, who had miraculously made sure that she didn't run into the house or run into anything else, and she survived and the house was unharmed. So that was that was extremely compelling to me. But shortly after that, unfortunately, then I think, I don't know if that drew attention to the house being there, if it was considered dangerous, but the house was torn down. Okay. And the next time I saw it, it was like green grass growing over an empty lot as if it had never been there.
Yeah. When you obviously became an adult and decided to write the book, This House, about that house, what was your intent with writing the book? What was your end goal by documenting and somewhat kind of trying to have an account of what happened?
Yeah. So I also want to mention that if you look on the cover of that book, it is the actual house, and you can see the guardrail sitting on the porch. That photo that I took was taken right after that accident. So you can actually see the guardrail sitting on the porch. It originally began as a short story, and it's still not a very long book. It's technically it's like a young adult book, but it helped my career take off as a paranormal personality. So mostly it's been like adults who are kind of ghost hunter investigator people that have read it. What I wanted to do was share the kind of tale of that sort of coming of age, that fascination and, you know, that longing and, you know, indulging in the mysteries of the world and what a beautiful world we have around us, even though things are dark and ugly and there's death and things like that. That was my intention. I am a cancer survivor, so I started writing the book. I had cancer when I was 22, mm-hmm. and I started writing the book while I was going through treatment. Mm-hmm. So that was so those two things are very connected to me, that sense of nostalgia as well as, like, you know, finding a deeper meaning. And I did find it interesting. The book took off and helped sort of launch my writing career and my career as this paranormal personality or whatever you want to call me. And so it felt like, you know, Walter or this house wanted their story to be told, because it's ended up touching a lot of people's lives in different ways.
Kind of a cathartic experience, just going and reliving that time in your childhood while you were going through one of the most difficult times, I'm sure, of your life.
Yeah, it was. It really was. And it reminded me of, just how magical it is to be a part of the world that we live in, even though, you know, I was always fascinated by ghosts. That, you know, it doesn't mean being fascinated by death, but certainly it means being interested and sort of when I was in that state of having cancer and sort of walking the line between, like, life and death, it became even more meaningful. And then it launched my career, which I've seen as this serendipitous thing, the synchronous thing that so I've been, you know, continuing to tell Walter's story for 10 years. The book is going to come out this year in its 10th anniversary edition. So
when you were going through that, when you were going through your battle with cancer at 22 and writing the book and reliving some of these experiences, did ghosts bring you comfort? Did the idea of ghosts and how close you yourself came to possible death and all those things going through your mind, it's something that I think only someone who would have gone through that moment in their life could really truly answer honestly, is just the concept that we have of ghosts, of being a spirit that lives on still in our own environment, not necessarily going here or there, but still in our own areas. Was that a comforting thought to you at the time?
You know, that's such an excellent question, because that really wasn't the comforting part. So I've never found comfort in the idea that there might be an afterlife or that people might go on as ghosts or spirits. Mm-hmm. That's something that is fascinating to me, but it's not something that I would even personally look forward to. I joke about, like, the kind of ghost I hope to be one day. But for me, I think it was a little bit more abstract at the time, just kind of connecting with my interests, connecting with what made the world an interesting place to live in, having that fear of death, not hoping to, stick around or leave. It's interesting. It's hard for me to phrase, I guess, how I felt. I felt comforted by what I was assuming were, you know, good spirits around me. Like, I felt, I would dream of, like, my grandmother, for instance. I even had a dream about Walter, that he had come to me to comfort me while I was sick. So in that sense, I can say that brought me comfort. But the idea of ghosts or the afterlife or proof of this, that, and the other has actually never really impacted me in that sense. The more the time goes on, the more that concept actually kind of frightens me.
Sure.
I guess.
Okay. Once you had finished the book and you had gone through your recovery process, how did you continue your journey, if you will, into the world of the paranormal? What were some of the next steps that you took getting involved in your interests and passion evolving there?
When I became a teenager, I teamed up with some friends who were also excited about history and folklore and abandoned places. And we, you know, a lot of it was word of mouth about, like, you know, this haunted place in Harford County, Maryland. And we would drive out there and we had access to Baltimore and D.C. and Gettysburg and all these really neat places that are chock full of history and hauntings. So we would drive around late at night. We would take day trips. So it was sort of like this continued, suburban exploring and not so much like official ghost hunting. So after I was done with all my treatment and done with college, I moved to Chicago. And that's when I got serious about my writing career and really getting into like the world of publishing. And it's also when I joined my first like official ghost hunting paranormal investigation group and started to kind of put my toe in the water of how it's done more to the style now that I would say mimics what people, have been doing on TV for the last like 10 or 15 years. And from there, it's just been a long process of evolving. So I don't really consider myself like a paranormal investigator. I do consider myself like a storyteller and somebody who's interested. And, I'm like a lifelong learner and conveyor, I guess, interpreter of information and stories related to the paranormal. So, but I do love writing about it, and I do love a good adventure. So,
when you got to Chicago and you started to examine that area, obviously, totally different part of the country, still that area chock full, also with its own set of ghost stories. What were some of the first areas that really intrigued you that you started to dig into and investigate a bit in your own way?
I was super, super stoked to explore Bachelor's Grove. So I had grown up hearing about Bachelor's Grove. And when I learned that, Chicago was only an hour away from there, or an hour away from Resurrection Cemetery, where Resurrection Mary had been seen, I was like, oh my gosh, I've hit the jackpot.
Give us the backstory a little bit on Bachelor's Grove.
Sure. So Bachelor's Grove is a small cemetery, I believe, with under 200 burials that was began interring people around like the late 1830s, early 1840s. And during the time around the 1950s and 60s, it became a place that was known as like a lover's lane. And people would kind of go out there to the cemetery and desecrate the graves. And over time, it has become known as one of the most haunted cemeteries on earth. And it's a very, you can really feel it. It's a really palpable feeling when you walk towards, there's this little trail that you walk out to the cemetery, which used to be a highway, which is how people would access the cemetery and how it kind of became this legendary place along this like lover's lane. You walk along there now and you approach the cemetery, and it's just a very tiny little unassuming place. Most of the grave sites are gone because they were all smashed to bits or desecrated in some way. But you can just feel, you wouldn't even have to know that there was anything, that there was any sort of stories about the place, and you would feel that it was had a lot of powerful energy.
Oh. So when you started to get there and begin to do some investigating, what were you finding? What were you looking for?
I was keeping an open mind as to what may have been out there. I had heard a few stories. A lot of the stories that are associated with the Grove are not necessarily based in fact. So I had heard stories about like the lagoon being like a body dump for gangsters or something like that. But there's really no historic evidence to support that. There's stories of people hearing cars pulling up and slamming on the brakes, and then somebody hearing a splash in the water or something like that, which is still an important, cool urban legend. But I guess I was just kind of there. This was around my first time there, I think, was 2009. So I was just there with open eyes and open ears, ready to experience whatever was there. I had seen the picture of the Madonna of Bachelor's Grove, which is like that famous photo of the woman sitting, the famous black and white picture of a woman sitting on a gravestone. So mm-hmm. I was like, who knows what else, what I'll encounter. And I ended up having sort of seeing these lights in the woods that people talk about. And one of the lights even resembled to me a window. And I thought for a moment, I was looking into like the window of somebody's house. Mm-hmm. And I had this impression that there was a house in the woods. And then I came to find later that the phantom, a house of Bachelor's Grove is one of the most infamous stories attached to the place.
The Phantom House, was this a house that once stood and is not there anymore that people tend to see from time to time? Or how does that legend go?
It is hotly debated. So this house changes locations within the cemetery. So people will see it in all different places. And there are plenty of foundations for different houses in the area. None of them seem to match, you know, the description that people have of the house, which is sort of like old white farmhouse with a porch swing type of thing. A lot of people would sort of conjure up that same image. When Ursula Bielski, who's a famous face in Chicago when it comes to like hauntings and everything, she was researching and she found that there was an old white farmhouse that, you know, was built close to Bachelor's Grove that matches the description of the house that people see. The interesting thing is that the house kind of moves and changes shape and disappears. And to me, that is like, to me, that's the part that's just super creepy. Especially since, you know, I can believe in ghosts and spirits. I don't know what they are, but I know I've seen one, so I can believe in that. But there's something very like eerie and sort of sinister about the idea of a house that can sort of present itself. And people tend to get like an ominous feeling when they see it.
That wraps up part one of our conversation with Amelia Cotter about, are they really dead? In part two of our conversation, we're going to dive deeper into her life and her journey to Chicago and discuss the many ghosts of the great city of Chicago. We'll also ask Amelia, what does she think of ghost houses or property that's showing themselves to one person where they once stood or at a different place in time? What happened to the 38,000 people who were once buried in what is now Chicago's Lincoln Park? How haunted is the park with the remaining 13,000 bodies still buried there? Why did the city of Chicago decide to ignore the bodies of the nearly 40,000? And on to another location in the city of Chicago, the Redunning area, a place where nearly 40,000 were once buried, and many are still. Do the spirits of the Eastland ship disaster still haunt the piers of Chicago? A disaster that claimed the life of more than 800 in the early 1900s. All of that and more in part two of our conversation with Amelia Cotter. To hear it, become a gravekeeper. That's a supporter of our program. You sign up to become one at patreon.com/thegravetalks or go to our website, thegravetalks.com, and follow the links to become a gravekeeper. At $5, we'll get you access to part two of this conversation and all of our conversations with all of our guests. Hundreds of interviews just waiting for you to binge away on right now at patreon.com/thegravetalks. You also get access to our programs months before they're released to the public. It's all there for you at thegravetalks.com. Click become a gravekeeper. Until next time for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.